Thank you very much, Leslie. I'm just going to click the one button I know how to click, which is that one. And it didn't work. So I'll click it again. Oh, it's up. Here it is. Okay. Thank you very much, and thank you all for attending a 3 o'clock lecture on a Friday on a sunny day. that's going some, I think. As researchers, I think most of us would like to think that we walk bravely forward with a plan, but the reality is that most of us bump into things along the way, and sometimes we have to walk backwards in order to understand enough to go forwards again. And this is sort of the story of how that happened to me. For the past 25 years, I've been studying the development of colonial print cultures, especially the role of institutions that support print culture, like libraries and newspapers and publishing houses. But most especially, voluntary associations such as literary societies, debating clubs, and writers' unions. Much of this activity is connected to colonial systems of education. And since it's a hallmark of colonialism that public education is neither affordable nor accessible or of particularly high quality, adult education takes on a disproportionately high role, a large role, in colonial life, basically as a means of ensuring that effective daily operations of the colonial administration can carry on. During decolonization, adult education takes on an additional role, that of preparing citizens for independence. In the exploitation colonies of the late British Empire, the establishment of women's clubs was a form of adult education. These clubs were basically started up by expatriate women living in the colonies who had an interest in development. And many of them had been WI members in Britain and had formed WIs in the colonies in which they were living. So they set up racially segregated clubs for colonized women and then tried to teach them how to run meetings and develop leadership and all sorts of the same sorts of things that WI had done for them in Britain. I first stumbled across these women's clubs when I was working on the literary life of Papua New Guinea, and then I found similar instances in East and West Africa. And so I kind of got interested. I didn't really know very much about WI, but I decided that I would kind of find out what the British WIs were all about. And to my surprise, when I began studying them, I came to realize that the Women's Institutes movement is actually not British at all. It's Canadian. It was an export from Canada to the UK during the First World War. It was started originally in 1897 in southern Ontario. And it isn't even a Canadian invention, although the specific shape of WI in Canada is quite different from that anywhere else. It's a sort of government-sponsored NGO, and it's a very peculiar Canadian sort of thing to do in Canada. But its roots actually lie in agrarian movements of various types in the U.S. The Grange Movement, with which many people will be familiar, the Farmers Institutes, and a very large network of women's clubs. And this is what we found actually quite important in the shaping of the WIs in Canada, because many of the early leaders of the WIs in Canada were American women who had come to live here. So this was mildly interesting, but I had to ask myself, was this interesting enough to justify 2 years of hard labor? And I would not actually have pursued this particular adult education trail, but for two things. The first was a suggestion of Rory McGrail that the university wanted to encourage faculty to establish research websites. And I had begun to digitize hard-to-find and rare documents relating to colonial print culture for eventual inclusion on a research website. So I had a little bit of background with digital collections. The second thing that happened was my friend Nadine, who works on this project with me but who is not here today, was trained as a rural sociologist, and at one time she served as of the executive director of the Alberta Women's Institute, so the WI, and she'd been speaking to me about WI for a long time. And so I was sort of vaguely familiar with that, and I hadn't actually connected that with the British WI for some reason. In talking to May and then in doing some subsequent research, I came to realize the importance of the Alberta Women's Institute for Alberta history. The oldest of the branches was established in 1909 by a woman who had emigrated here from Ontario. The provincial government picked up on the fact that women were interested in establishing these branches and organized it as a government-sponsored NGO in 1912. It is certainly the largest over time of the rural women's organizations, and at the height of the organization's power in the mid-1950s, there were over 300 branches across the province and well over 10,000 members. In the early years of the province, it was a magnet for women who had an interest in women's suffrage. So Emily Murphy and Nellie McClung, who were early, who were members of the Famous Five, were members of the WI. And in fact, Emily Murphy became the first president in 1919 of the National Association of Women's Institutes. She was quite serious about her involvement in the organization and in what the organization could do for women. Nellie McClung helped organize many branches across the province, and she was a popular speaker. And of course, you know, what are they doing? But they're talking to people about issues like the vote. In subsequent years, several other prominent women have come out of the WI experience. Martha Beelish, who was the first Ukrainian woman to serve as a senator in Ottawa. Joe Clark put her up for that seat in 1979. And she was in the Senate for 11 years. Cornelia Wood, who's a long-serving member of the Legislative Assembly here in Alberta, was also a WI member. Aside from the sort of people who have prominence, though, when you look at the leadership of this, basically the century of WI, the leadership, those women were very, very active across their communities. Now, I don't expect you to read this. I just wanted to point out a couple of things about this particular chart. This is for Marion Rogers, who was born in 1882, died in 1976. She came from Ontario, where she was a WI member, first to Saskatchewan, where she joined a similar organization called the Homemakers Club. Then she came to Alberta for Saskatchewan and joined again. So as a young woman, she's obviously finding that this organization is helping her connect with other women and to do things in the community that she felt were necessary. What I'd like you to do is to concentrate on that area between about 1917 and 1942. You can see that she starts to have multiple leadership roles, both in the Women's Institute's organization locally in Alberta and nationally, and in other organizations as well. So she starts to climb the leadership ladder from the branches and eventually becomes vice president in Alberta. At the same time, she becomes the corresponding secretary for the national group, the recording secretary for them as well, so she holds different positions. And she's secretary treasurer of the Alberta School Trustee Association and then editor of the Alberta School Trustees magazine. So this one was really involved in community work, and this is a typical profile of the women who sought leadership in this particular organization. They were on school boards, all kinds of community organizations, mayors, councils, and so on. And basically from the age of about in her late 30s to the age of 60, this is Rogers' most productive period. So as I'm looking at the organization, I'm realizing it's kind of a two-tiered organization. It's fascinating. There's the NGO part, and that pretty much resides in the provincial office and in the upper echelons of the organization, which is set up by the government to serve as a kind of silo for information. So the WI then becomes the vehicle through which a lot of adult education, agricultural extension work happens. home economists come out to the various institutions, and the WIs are very involved in, communities, and the WIs are involved in making sure that knowledge is spread through the community. So courses on hygiene and nutrition and home management and farm safety and that sort of thing find their way into rural communities through the WIs. They also serve as a kind of bellwether for the government. Each year the organization has a conference, and from that conference a series of resolutions are sent back up to the Minister of Agriculture. Now, because this is a nonpartisan kind of NGO-ish sort of organization, the WIs never had any political clout to make sure that various resolutions that it sends to the government are heard or acted on, but a large number of them have been. So they're clearly sending things up from a very early time. You know, they want a VON in Alberta, we get a VON. They're not the only women's organization asking for these things, but because of the large numbers of women in WI, it's certainly a way for the government to find out what many people want to do. The whole notion of you know, well baby clinics and you know, the safety strips that are on the sides of tractors, that's the result of WI agitation and so on. And certainly being a part of an organization which is controlled to a large extent because they're receiving money from the government, they are taught how to run meetings, certain leadership skills and so on. So it's set up as a learning organization, which is taken quite seriously. Many people in this room and listening to this talk will remember the Murdoch case, and the whole issue of women's dower rights and so on is one which WI took up and was quite serious about. Now, many of you have probably heard the term pink tea. This is a notion which came from the U.S. across the border with many of the women who moved here. I guess if I was looking for something that was symbolized WI, it would be a teacup, and you'll have a look at one in a few minutes in the presentation. But for WI holding teas, it was basically tea with a purpose. So the pink tea was a way of educating women on how to vote. So what you do is you dress everybody up in pink, and you frilly up the hall and wherever they are, and no self-respecting male is going to walk in. And you have to remember that the meetings were very often held in tandem with meetings that their husbands were attending, and quite often there were men attending in the early days the WI meetings, and women who were at the Farmers Institute's meetings or the UFA meetings and so on. But it was a very good way of keeping men out of the room if you wished to do so. You could then close the door and bar it if you wanted to. And then you could set up sample booths, voting booths. You could show people what this was all about. And teas were also used as a means of raising money. And this organization was extremely effective in raising money in rural Alberta. And that's sort of the local level of the organization, which I think is by far the most interesting. WI became one of the most effective fundraising organizations throughout the province. In the early days, WIs raised the money for the libraries, the cottage hospitals, the covered arenas, the community halls, restrooms for women, and cemeteries. Much of the infrastructure of this province was built on fundraising by this particular organization. They became the go-to organization in many communities for fundraising. A lot of the early hospitals were actually owned by the WI. The Waterhole Hospital, which became the Fairview Hospital, was owned and controlled by the WI in the 1920s. The women of Serial built a hospital in 1919, and which was eventually turned over to the community. And one of the reasons, I think, that very few people know that the WIs were responsible for this infrastructure was they did not insist that their name remain on the building after it had been turned over. They essentially erased themselves from history as they were making it. You would have a very hard time going across the province to find very many buildings that had a sign that said this is the WI library or even a plaque on the building. You know, unlike the Kingsmen and the Kiwanis who plaster their names all over everything they do. And so it's one of the things that intrigued me about the organization.
Can I ask why?
why did they do this?
Yeah.
I think that it was just an eminently practical organization. As far as they were concerned, they were just doing things that had to be done. And it wasn't for their own glory at all. It was simply they needed a hall, and there was a hall, and they moved on, and they raised money for the Red Cross or whatever the next thing was. In my talks with people in WI, they don't have that sense of themselves, that historical sense of themselves, although they've been involved in writing all kinds of history books. But it's all been very internal and very sort of within the organization. It's one of the anomalies. You look at it and you think, well, what on earth? I have a little quote here from one of the histories that they've written, which basically shows you the attitude. In 1945, the WI in Serial, Alberta, relinquished all claim to the building, the hospital, and its contents, and turned it over without receiving a cent to the Municipal Hospital Board. But a plaque was put on the building. The plaque says the original building was given by the Prairie Circle. This is the Prairie Circle Women's Institute. So the Women's Institute isn't even in on the plaque for a hospital in 1918. It's really quite fascinating. After that early period when they were so busy establishing infrastructure, once the halls were built and the libraries were in place and so on, they turned to fundraising for causes of one kind or another. They were very, very active during both World Wars, sending parcels to soldiers overseas and to supporting WIs in Britain, where women there simply didn't have enough to keep their families clean and fed and so on. Women in Canada were busy canning up jams and fruits and so on and sending these things to Britain. In 1939, they began a program of raising money for radium sticks for cancer therapy, and this was a large push for this organization. In 1939 alone, they raised $2,000. It's a significant sum. They just continued. Whatever the perceived need was, the WI would raise money for it. The other, salient thing about the local side of WI, and probably what's kept it going all of these years, is the fellowship. Most of the women who started the organization had come from Eastern Canada with more heavily populated areas or urban areas, certainly urban areas in Europe, and the women who had come here from the States, if they didn't come from an urban area, they came from a country where women's clubs were much older and far better organized and so on. And they were simply lonely, and they were having children and raising them in less than optimal circumstances. So to be able to have an organization where they could meet once a month and support one another in all kinds of ways was critical to the sanity of many of them. So I became kind of hooked on the organization that appeared to have been everywhere and done so much, but that nobody remembers or knows very much about. Then May told me about the Women's Institute's Books of Remembrance. The Books of Remembrance reside in boxes in the provincial archives. They have the size and appearance of Gutenberg Bibles. They're about 4 to 5 inches thick at least. They're huge. And are written, handwritten in copperplate script. Each page contains the biography of a WI member, and there are about 1,000 of these. And no one ever sees them. I remember looking down at the volumes. They're in boxes. You have to wear gloves to handle them. I mean, it's a rarefied experience looking at these things. And I thought, I have just discovered the WI Book of the Dead. My next thought was, how can this document be made more available to people interested in women's narratives? Well, I was sort of in digitization mode, so I arranged to have the first Book of Remembrance digitized at my own expense, and I must admit I had no idea what I was going to do with the file. I just thought something had to be done with it. Eventually, I went to see Steve Schaefer, who very generously offered to repay me if I would take the file to Tony Tin. Now, I don't know how many of you have talked to Tony Tin, likely a lot of you, but I have always found it to be a mistake. Tony has far too many ideas. By the time I left his office, I was convinced that my little disk could be part of an important digital collection, and from then on, I just kissed my spare time goodbye. As a means of enabling the work, May and I applied for a Community Initiatives Project grant from the provincial government, and we received $50,000 to establish a website that would mark the contribution of AWI to Alberta's history. With the opportunity to apply for a second year of funding to expand the website with some educational materials and develop a touring exhibit to mark the organization's centennial in 2009. And we're already working with the archives to do that. So we have a partnership between the Alberta Women's Institutes and our own university and the archives. The website will be ready for launch at the end of February 2009. All the digitization, we've done thousands of pages, all of the digitization is complete from AU. The archives is just finishing up a little bit. The site is fully searchable. The project is intended to serve a wide audience, scholars who want to have access to some of these primary documents, teachers and students, the general public. We have documents, lots of photos. We have increased the number of photos, certainly, that the archives had. We've taken many, many interviews. We've reduced into audio and video files, so there's lots of participation by the women in the organization. The documents that we have digitized are quite wide-ranging. We started with the three books of remembrance, and there are three life membership books. Now, this is a little different kind of narrative. The life membership books are biographies of the women while they're alive, so those narratives are longer and the different approach taken to the life, I think. Life membership is an honor, basically. People are given the life membership as a recognition while they're alive of their contribution and so on, and they never have to pay dues again. The scrapbooks, which are really local histories of the individual branches, we have digitized many of these. Selected minutes, a lot of the WIs have been in existence for 100 years and have 100 years of minutes. And so we can't digitize them all, but we've got some representative ones. Patricia was just telling me that she comes from a WI family and from Conjuring Creek, which is one of those branches that actually has a very long run of minutes. Yes, yes. Well done. As I said, the organization is very interested in history, so there are branch histories and there are district histories and there are histories from the provincial level, and we have digitized everything we can find. Convention reports and programs, newspaper articles and so on, and then we have the interviews and so on as well. This is not a particularly interesting picture of the cover of the Book of Remembrance. And just remember that's on top of 5 inches or so, and it's all deeply engraved. It's in leather. It's really quite beautiful. And here is an example of an entry. Now, each of the women for whom we've digitized a page from the Books of Remembrance or the Life Membership has her own page on the website. The woman's page will have the digitized copies of the various things that have been written about her, photographs, any other documents that have to do with the woman. Each single one of these is read. There's a woman's voice. If you click on them, you can hear women reading them. This copper plate has been transcribed into text files that are searchable. So the entire site is searchable. And I'm just going to click here because the woman reading this particular one, The woman reading this particular bio is the great-granddaughter of Mary Riley. So I'll just play this for you.
My name is Connie Farr, and I'm the 23rd granddaughter of Mary Riley, from an employee of the Lancashire more for their family than their circumstances could provide in England. They immigrated to Canada in 1905 and took up a homestead near Golden in what is now known as the Garrison District, where the hardships of those pioneer days on the Little Western Sod Farm only acted as a challenge to Mary Riley. This charming little Lancashire lady was ever ready to lend a helping hand in sickness or in any kind of trouble, at a time when doctors and hospitals were practically an unknown quantity in this new land. She saw the need for spiritual guidance and helped organize the first Sunday school in the community. When she heard of the WIs and what this new organization could do for isolated rural women, she was instrumental in forming the Garrison Clark Creek WI in 1917. She was their first president and remained active until shortly before her death in November of 1925.
And here is a picture of Mary Riley holding a book, as you can see, and she was one of the great supporters of libraries, and this was important for her to have this particular photo part of the exhibit, part by her great-granddaughter, part of the exhibit. In addition to these biographies,
sorry, Karen offsite had a question, and before we scroll past it, she's wondering if what your plans are for providing access to the various interested parties and who will have access to the database once it's finished.
The entire site will be available to the general public. So the archives will link to it, the organization will link to it, and it'll be part of the university's digital collections. So it'll be completely open to anybody who wants to have a look at it. The database I haven't talked about yet, but we've constructed a database certainly out of all of the information we're gleaning from these biographies, and we're using that to start pulling demographic information, ways of representing the this certain amount of coded language in these biographies and trying to figure out what that means and so on. So after we finish tinkering with it, yes, I'd like to make that available, I think, to students at the university who would like to play around with this. And we're just starting actually today to start drawing reports from it, and we're still working the bugs out of that. So it'll be a little while before we're ready to work on that. So aside from these bios, we've got a complete run of the organization's newsletter. This is from a kind of a mock-up website that the library did for us. From 1936 onwards, and so people can flip through every single edition. And this is a particularly interesting document in comparison to the ones that I'm speaking of, because this is where the university or the organization sees what it does now. So there's no focus on history whatsoever. And the obits are just little perfunctory, so-and-so died, you know, such and such date in such and such community, you know, on to what we're doing. It's really quite interesting. So the various purposes that they have for communicating themselves to themselves are very much compartmentalized in different sorts of documents. So that's there for people to look through, and there's some creative writing in there. There's all kinds of interesting things. Here's a sample of documents that we have digitized. Women's institutes have lots and lots of handbooks, you know, how to run a club, how to run a meeting, great ideas for organizations and so on. There's a focus on creative writing in the organization, so there are collections of short stories and poems, so we've digitized everything. And a lot of this material, I can talk about that a little bit later if you like, was organized as part of a development project similar to what I had found in Africa and in the South Pacific, encouraging Native women in Alberta to form their own WIs, and the information then would be provided to them about how to do that. So we have quite a range of documents, and certainly handicrafts were just hugely important. They still are to the women's institutes, and we have photographed at their annual convention last year, and we will this coming year as well, the prize winners. This particular quilt belongs to Mary Turner, whose mother was in the WI, and she gave us the loan of a huge and absolutely beautiful collection of quilts. And we got Blaze to go with us down to Fort Edmonton Park, and we flung these quilts around, you know, across barn doors and all kinds of places and took the most beautiful photos. So there's a whole story behind the handicrafts in this organization, and this is just a sample. As I mentioned, teacups are important. And so this is Ruth Stange, who very kindly brought in her entire WIT set to the Wetaskiwin office one day and allowed us to photocopy her. And keeping in mind, again, that the teacup has symbolic importance in this organization. We have photocopied everything that has the WI logo on it, or we photographed, rather, not photocopied. Now, maps. We will have, using a Google facility, a way for users to go increasingly down to the local level and then click, and that's the branch, and each branch has its own page, and so you get to the accomplishments of each of the branches and you know, any documents that we have associated with them. But we also wanted to do something with distribution, to have some sense of the growth and decline of the organization, because they're down to 40 branches and a few hundred old ladies, I mean really old ladies, and we wanted to have some sense of that. Now, my partner, May Deans, had, when she worked for them, worked up, this is one of three maps, and they're very large, where she was trying to do the distribution in 20-year slices, just to show, I think, the most recent one she had done was in 2000. And you know, we did them, we put them on here. Well, the other day, Tony sent me a URL. He said, Evan, you have to look at this. So I clicked on it because I do everything Tony tells me. And it was a map of the United States showing the growth of Walmart from its very beginnings down in Arkansas or somewhere, across, spreading like a cancer, really, across the country. And every single Walmart store is represented by this sort of little round pulsing globe. it's quite actually scary in a way to look at it, but it just gives you this really great idea of the growth of the organization. Down in one corner, the years are flipping by, and up in another corner, the number of stores are flipping by. You can zoom in and zoom out and on. Anyway, I was telling Tony this is, I thought it was swell, and if we could do it so that we see the rise of the organization and then the decline of the organization over time, that would really give some sense of the life of this voluntary association. So anyway, that's the current thing we're playing with. We have included a number of contextual essays on each of the pages where we feel that people might want to know a little bit more about these kinds of organizations, the climate in which the WI was operating. I've got an essay in there on the sort of relationships between WI and the UFWA, which is United Farm Workers, Farm Wives of Alberta. It was an auxiliary of the UFA. And obviously a number of references and resources. In the second year, we plan on including digital walking tours of various communities in the province, and I stole this idea from the city of St. John's, Newfoundland, where they, again using a Google Map a tool, they will have a map of a certain neighborhood in the city of St. John's, and you can go as a tourist, or you know, if you've been away and you've come home and you want to sort of connect yourself back up again. They found information whether, you know, Joey Smallwood lived in this neighborhood or a certain writer was here or some event happened. There's a little narrative in one screen, sometimes with video and audio clips, sometimes just with photographs. So you get a sense of something. And I thought that this would be fun to do and then to take to teachers to see whether or not teachers in some of these areas might like to play with this with their students and then upload this. So we've started that those discussions. So anyway, that is basically what we've been up to. It's a question of sitting down at this point and deciding what we've learned. And I know certainly I've learned that digital collections are a great deal more than collections of information. The idea of putting women's voices all the way through here came to me from watching a demonstration of the Heritage Resource Management Program has a lovely project in Boyle, Alberta, where they've been talking to farmers and going through their their photograph album. So online, you can go through and click on a photo, and you get the guy's voice saying, "This is me and my brother Fred on the Baylor in 1934." I thought, "Oh, that's just amazing! We have to do this." So that's that was kind of the beginning of our playing around with voice, and obviously we have the visual things. I also discovered that you can search across collections. I'm not a very technologically astute person, as you can imagine from that statement, but I didn't know this. And so I discovered that we could connect this with other collections that the university has that are relevant, and one of them is one that Nancy Langford has worked on. She's in the room here, and it's the collection of women's fawns. Where are they? Which archives have fawns for women right across the province? Well, of course, many of those fawns are related to Women's Institute's members and so on. So Nancy and I have made a pact that later on this year we are going to talk about that and see what we can do so that anybody visiting these sites, will have the full benefit of the breadth of them, I suppose. I've been talking to Rhiannon about connecting up with women's studies courses. The resources here in this website, I can certainly tie into a number of communication courses and units and so on. Organizational communication, there's just so much stuff here that I can use. Narrative analysis, looking at the different representations of individual members and of the organization as a whole. Someday I'd like to write a course in book history, and I could certainly connect it up there as well. And Alvin's here, either there may be history courses that this may be of use for. Another thing that I've certainly learned and been thinking about is that once you go out into the community with a project like this and you're working with a community organization, of course there are all sorts of things that come to you that you never could have imagined. So many of these branches are nearly expired, and the idea of this website and the idea of what we can do with archived materials has spurred many branches to organize their papers and deposit them, which is a really good thing. And they wanted to give them all to me, and I said, no, don't do that. And so we have been talking with various archives across the province and hooked people up with the appropriate folk. And a book came our way. One of the women that we interviewed in Viking, she's 90, and she's as sharp as a tack, and she lives in the lodge in Viking, came to me and said, "Ellen, I want you to take my book." I said, "What book would that be, Elizabeth?" She said, "Well, I've been in WI for 70 years, and for the last 40, I've been writing the book about what I've learned and my growth through the organization. It's 1,000 pages long." And so I talk to her every week. Every Wednesday morning we talk, and we work through another few pages of it. We're bringing it down. It is an extraordinary document. So we will put that on the website for people, and we will also help her see if there's some way she can get the thing published, and probably be talking to Erna about that at some point to get some professional advice. Ah, okay, wonderful. Nancy's just telling me that she's already there and I just have to catch up to her. So those are several of the things I've learned, some of the many things that I've learned. As far as the research is concerned, as I mentioned a little earlier, I've never studied an organization from the inside this way before, and looked at the way it tries to represent itself. And so that's been really instructive. So when I start moving forward again into the other material that I've been working on, I think I certainly have learned a great deal. One thing I've really learned about is organizational mythology. Now, everyone here, I think, works for except for my husband, works for Athabasca University, and we're all pretty much familiar with organizational myths. But I'd never looked at an organization I had nothing to do with before, to look at their mythology. And there are two large informing myths of this particular group. The first is, I could call it kind of a maternal feminist sort of myth. There is a saint associated with the Women's Institutes. Her name is Adelaide Hoodless. Now, Adelaide Hoodless had, I don't know, maybe about 5 minutes brush with the WIs in southern Ontario, but she's been adopted by the Women's Institutes as the woman who who formed up the whole organization. It's a complete historical myth. She didn't. But I think what happened was she told them a story that resonated, and it's a story that they've held on to ever since. I can't count the number of women here in Alberta who keep repeating this story to me when I tell them about, ask them what does WI mean to you and so on. The Farmers Institutes in Southern Ontario were interested in having some kind of parallel organization for their wives, because their wives were wanting to do that. Hoodless, who was an activist in the 1890s, was asked to give a talk to the WI, and then asked by the local, or the Farmers Institute, and asked then by, I think it was the president, to talk to the women and help them organize something for themselves. That's literally what she did. And then she toddled off and had a nice life. But what she did was she told them the story, her own private story, about why she was doing this work. Her main interest was in domestic science, the education of women. As a young wife, she had one of her children had died because she, as a mother, did not have enough information to treat the child and take the child in for medical care. It was a completely preventable death. And she had sworn to herself she would never let this happen again for herself or for anyone else. Now, I can just imagine that room in 1897 in Southern Ontario. There were probably many other women who had had precisely the same experiences. And that story has resonated ever since. It's at the basis of all of this Holman Hearth kind of focus in WI, courses on nutrition and hygiene and health and all of that sort of thing. The other informing myth that we came across has been called by some historians equity feminism. And this is the Emily Murphy, Nellie McClung side of the institution. People in WI are fiercely proud of the fact that they are nobody's female auxiliary. Now, this despite the fact that they receive a grant from the federal government, or from the provincial government, and despite the fact that actually the organization of WI was set up as a kind of auxiliary to the farm. That's okay, that doesn't exist. What really exists is that they feel themselves to be women who can solve problems, who can move, who can act, and so on. And in Alberta, there's this interesting kind of stress and tension between, especially in the early years of the century, between the UFWA and the AWI in that sense, because the women of United Farm Women of Alberta were an auxiliary of the union, but they were political, right? AWI wasn't. They had overlapping but not necessarily the same kinds of roles at all. So it's really fun to look at the interplay between these two organizations, but that is part of that let's learn how to vote, let's make comments about the Murdoch case, let's make sure our daughters have a good education and get good jobs. That side of WI comes from that particular informing myth. And then, as I mentioned a little earlier, we've put a database together, and we just started pulling reports. So we want to know, for example, if we have our hunches, if we can find relationships between the level of education of the women, the number of children they have, and the kinds and numbers of leadership they take within the organization. Is there a relationship between the church they belong to and their assumption of leadership, and so on. The research assistant just pulled some of this for me about 10 minutes before I came, and I thought, yes! The first generation of leader, and we're counting that as women born before 1900, and so these people would have been arriving in Alberta shortly after the turn of the century. Over 30% of those women were teachers, nurses, or had university degrees. They were highly, highly educated people. Compared to their daughters and their granddaughters, who got stuck on those farms and didn't have a chance to, and the depression hit and the war hit and all this. So there's kind of an inverse situation with that first group than one might imagine. And we're just looking at the percentages of them who took up leadership roles, and it's really high. So these are the kinds of things we're starting to play with. I'll stop talking in a second. I had seen a wonderful study conducted by Ann Boylan in the U.S. on Afro-American women's clubs, where they had tried to look at social statuses, and affiliations and so on. And they had found very direct correlations between certain kinds of things. One that I thought was hilarious, looking at the number of children a woman had and then the number of leadership roles she had, and finding that if a woman had, let's say, three or less, she was very likely to pick up a leadership role because it wouldn't have been hard for her to find someone to look after the kids. And if she had over 12 children, she was in exactly the same situation because the kids were of such a wide range of age. You can just get the older ones to look after the younger ones. The women who were really stuck were the ones with six, eight kids, you know. So these patterns are fun to look at. And the other thing that we're looking at is attributes, leadership attributes, personal attributes, and so on. So we have five large clusters of leadership attributes. We're calling the first pioneer. That's the most prestigious. The second one, loyal. Third one, willing. Fourth one, dedicated. And a fifth one, respected. Respected were the women who went to the top and no one liked them. And so there are a whole series of words and phrases that fit into each of these categories. And we're looking at the different ways that women were memorialized. So it's all in-house. They know very well no one's ever going to read these things. the ways in which they memorialize each other and remember, and then you can pick up values of the organization by doing this. So we're just starting this part. This bit's fun. We're just starting this bit. So I've had a lot of fun doing this, and I would encourage anybody at the university who's been tinkering with the idea of working on a digital collection to consider it and take your courage in your hand and go and knock on Tony Tin's door. I think you'll be glad you did. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Evelyn. That was excellent and very enlightening for some of us who didn't know anything about women's institutes, not being from here. Do we have any questions for Evelyn?
Yes, I have a couple of comments. First of all, I've had the privilege of listening to Evelyn describe this collection before, and I was it's Nancy Langford, sorry. And I was very impressed the first time, and I'm even more impressed to hear it all over again. And congratulations on some wonderful work you've done. I know how much work this is.
Thank you.
And I'm really impressed. Just a couple of things. I want to correct you on a couple of things. I'm the historian of the United Farm Women of Alberta. United Farm Women of Alberta was the largest organization of women. For a period of time, okay, for about 15 years.
I said over time because I knew you were going to say that.
Yeah. and significantly so, because they had over 30,000 members. So, you know, I just want to temper that comment about the largest women's organization, because for some periods in our history, that doesn't fit. The other thing is, for me, there's a really interesting thing in that dynamic between the two organizations, partly because they shared members. And that, for me, is a really interesting fact, that women in a community sometimes have a choice to join both. And those were the blessed communities, because even more activity was happening with two organizations. And sometimes competition pushed them pretty hard to do some amazing things. But have you run across in your research significant numbers of women talking about being both a United Farm Woman and a WI member, and comparing at all sort of the organizations or their experiences?
People have mentioned to me that they either were a member of both or knew people who were. I hadn't pursued that because we were focusing on the WI, but that would be a really interesting thing, Nancy, for us to look at. Certainly, there are people who don't care. We talk to people, you know, whichever one was in the community, we joined the one that was there. Sometimes there were communities with both. There are people in WI who say, oh, well, you know, we wouldn't have anything to do with them. And I found a rather interesting piece in one of the histories recently. Martha Graham, who was the woman who started up, as you know, the first WI branch in 1909, and had been a WI member in Ontario, chose within a very few number of years, once the UFWA was formed up, to leave WI and to move over to UFWA. And she's essentially then, after that point, written out of AWI history. She's never referred to again. Starting up the original branch. And there's no beatification of Martha Graham, I can tell you, at all. She really just isn't mentioned again. Just started up the first branch, and then she walks off the page because she defected.
Yep. Yes, Terry Anderson. Thanks, Evelyn. That was great. A couple of questions, one about the WI and then another about the research. But the, was the WI at all exclusively rural, or were there urban branches in the cities? And then secondly, I wondered if you could talk a little bit about the physical process of scanning these. Did you hire it out to another company? Did you do it yourself, more or less, or with God's assistance? Or how did the Book of the Dead and such, how did you actually do that?
Thanks, Terry. Yes, in fact, there are still members, branches in the cities. There was an Edmonton WI. They ran the tea house at the X for many years, and small towns and so on. In fact, as the farm population began to drift into the towns and villages and so on, the branches obviously closed in the country, many of them, and wherever the women were, that's where they had the branches. We haven't been able to address yet, we're going to see whether or not we can figure out if the same sort of pattern happened here as happened in Ontario, where it wasn't the farm-based branches that supported the WI there. It was actually small towns. So we haven't quite figured that one out yet. Here in this province, the WIs were basically named after school districts. And again, as things morphed and changed, sometimes it's hard to tell, you know, where most people lived. So I think we would maybe take some sample branches across the province and see if we can sort of track where people were and that sort of thing. We haven't done that work yet. As far as the scanning is concerned, when I had the first book done, I used the same company that the archives, they referred me to the company that does their work, and so that was done professionally. After we got the project grant, Tony Tim's group is wonderful people in the library, Colin Elliott and Sherry Coffey and Marcia and all these people have been working on the material for us. So a lot of the digitization has been done here at Athabasca. The archives has done some for us, and in order to finish up Home and Country newsletter, their equipment is there, but we've got WI volunteers coming in to use the equipment. Some of the material that we needed but don't want to put onto the website, I have a scanning bed of my own, and we just send the research assistant off to get it, but the quality isn't as good as we would like to have it. So, yeah, it's been done basically by the university. Yeah, and we had the grant to be able to buy people's time out and so on, and to actually buy some equipment for the library as well.
Just to follow up, it's Bob Heller. Is the Heritage Resource Program involved in this at all, or could this be something their interns could get involved with somehow?
They know we're doing it. We haven't talked to them yet, but we have ourselves talked about that possibility. This is one of the things I think would be the most interesting thing for us at the university to do, is to produce these things so that students can use them in effect as sort of a kind of lab, right? And I'm hoping the university will approve our proposal for a virtual media lab. We originally wanted this for our own program, and now Margaret says that it would be a great facility for the university. And we could literally have these kinds of activities happening online. And one single collection could then serve a number of courses or a number of students' individual projects and so on. I think that would be a wonderful idea.
I just want to kind of explore a bit more this relationship between the UFWA and the Women's Institutes. I mean, in my reading of the Women's Institutes, I would put more emphasis on their role as part of a state structure. I mean, I think you're right that they are. I mean, your term NGOs supported by the state, I think, is an accurate one. But I think the WIs end up in this kind of contradictory position, right, where they become both the WIs and the Farmers Institutes become this conduit through which the state is delivering its ideology about rural society. And you get the, and so they then they become part of and implicated in agricultural extension, both on the male side and the women's side. So the women's institutes become, in a sense, the conduit for that. So through that comes the developing ideologies of home economics and the kind of ideal notions of what it means to be a farm woman. Now, given that they are an NGO and that they are a voluntary organization, I think that it, that does get taken up in contradictory ways. But I think that that is an important frame there, that they are they do become this conduit for a kind of dominant ideology. Whereas the UFWA is contradictory in its own kind of way, but it is a autonomous movement, autonomous organization that, that is part of a broader political movement. And certainly in my, I mean, I'm most familiar with Manitoba, but when I look at, I know of examples from all three of the Prairie provinces where are the, there are these critical comments from the farm women's organizations about WI for those sorts of reasons. And similarly, as you've suggested, there is a sense on the WI side quite often that they're, that this is a different kettle of fish. But there is also, as Nancy suggested, I mean, there is this overlap, you know, and in a, and anybody who knows anything about rural communities, I mean, in this particular period, or in the early part of the 20th century when they were formed, I mean, they are, all of them are involved in community building exercises, but it is contradictory, I think.
Well, this is one of the fascinations of working with this organization. It's one of the first things we noticed that, there's on the one hand this and on the other hand that, all the way through the every level of the organization. And as I backed through and went to Ontario to have a look at the formation of it there and looked at the, for example, the relationship with the Grange movement, if you look at the origins of the Women's Institutes, and I suppose the Farmers Institutes as well, a lot of the values and the structures of the Grange movement, it was nonpartisan, non-sectarian, very, very egalitarian, and many sorts of parallels, I guess, that come across. So this idea of an organization that is not political in the way in which it, it operates is, you know, there's, there are roots there. But surely, I mean, it's one of the things that I think ultimately killed off the Farmers Institutes in Ontario was that you have this ideology coming from government saying there are problems in agriculture. The problem it is lack of education. And we have an agricultural college that will fix that for you, and we have experts. And there are problems with farm families, people leaving, you know, poor nutrition and all the rest of this sort of thing, and women are unhappy. The problem is they don't know enough. And so, and we have a home economics school that can fix that. And so, yeah, that comes right through. And the farmers, the UFO, I think it is, in Ontario, basically says, excuse us, there are more things wrong with agriculture than education. Try transportation rates and, you know, those sorts of things. So it's interesting to see those dynamics that you outlined, Jeff, basically happening at almost the same time because, of course, the United Farmers of Ontario become the government in the 20s, just as UFA does here, so that these cooperative movements and this movement on the other side to try and control, you know, agricultural populations on the other side, it's been a lot of fun to, for me to figure this out because I'm not a social historian at all, and so it's been a huge learning curve for me to kind of try and figure that context out. Alvin?
One of the points I was going to raise was Jeff's point, but I think he raised it a lot better. The other thing that I think is quite interesting that you might want to try and sort of fit into something of this kind is the way in which this particular kind of, on the one hand, obsequiousness of women as they're going about things goes on. That's going on the one hand, and you know, an attempt of individuals not to, you know, seem too big for their britches. But on the other, this ultra-meticulous keeping of every piece of information, almost as if they're waiting for you to come along, Evan. They're waiting for Nancy. I mean, you know, because these organizations have tons of material. And I just thought, too, that in terms of the larger history of the role of women in creating the, you know, our current medical system, that what was going on in terms of the Women's Institute was pretty typical. I mean, if you look at Quebec, it's the nuns who start all the hospitals, and then they give them away. They give them away because, you know, the American organization that accredits hospitals wants men, and especially doctors, running hospitals. So they give them away. In Saskatchewan, the it's the political women, actually, more than the Women's Institute, I think, Saskatchewan, who get the union hospitals going and the community doctors, which actually were more is more progressive than the kinds of hospitals that were being started here, which were, you know, they were community hospitals, but they were paying hospitals. You paid for your service. So there's a whole kind of history of women in terms of medical care that is piece by piece being written in the country, and I think, you know, there might be ways in terms of the website to link up to some of that other stuff, have it there, and make it more, you know, a broader issue of women's involvement in not only health care, but other things that we think of as purely coming from the state.
Thank you, Alvin. Just on that last note, I must say a chill came right down my spine about 3 months ago. May phoned me up and said, guess who just phoned me? The president of FWIC, which is the national WI. She said, we heard that you're doing this thing out in Alberta on, you know, digitize. You want to do ours? I said to May, no. So I think perhaps there might be an appetite for, you know, some of these. No. but with regard to the records, that, you're actually wrong on that. The only reason they keep the records is because the government requires them to. The only reason they get their grant each year is that they do keep these records. But when you actually go to look for them, you find that, you know, large swathes of them have been lost over time. You know, if somebody dies and someone looks at her papers and said, oh, this is just mom's stuff, right, and throws it away. And then also to get them to give it up. They hold on to it because it's theirs. And so part of this has been convincing them to actually deposit. There's just a huge kind of inward turning kind of, you know, attitude. So we had to basically say to people, look, we don't want to keep your stuff. We just want to take a picture of it. You know, we'll give it back to you. And the only reason we got so much from them, I think, is because of the social capital that May has with the organization. And that was just a huge thing. I could not have done this on my own because, you know, who am I? I'm a person from a university, and I have connections with the provincial archives, which they don't trust one bit.
Archie Zariski here, and thank you for your presentation, Evelyn. I found it very interesting, and it's given me many good ideas about connections between women's movements and feminism and the alternative dispute resolution field, which is heavily influenced by women's perspectives these days. It struck me that there were two alternative names they could have adopted for this organization. One would be the Rational Women's Institutes, because it does seem to me that what they were really about was proclaiming and developing the rational approach to domestic life, that it was capable of rational decision making and action, as opposed to patrimonial sort of conceptions of authority, for instance. So I presume that, or I might guess that they would even introduce such things as public speaking, debating, and that sort of thing as a model for decision making within domestic structures. The other name that occurred to alternative name was the Freematrons Institute, in the sense of their kind of secrecy and inward lookingness, And it reminds me that I think in many societies and for a long time, women have been the unofficial historians of domestic life. Certainly in our family, it's always the mothers and grandmothers who keep hoards of papers and photographs and things. The fathers don't seem to care about it as much. So I thank you for that. It stimulated a lot of ideas for me, and good luck on the rest of your work.
Thanks, Archie. It's interesting that you bring the Masons up, because the Grange movement was very much influenced by the Masonic tradition. And when we look at patterns of leadership in WI, there's very much this sort of 30-year apprenticeship kind of thing that happens. You know, you're not expected to skip a spot. You have to, you know, sort of move carefully through the ranks. And there's a certain pattern of the numbers of terms people have and so on. So obviously, I mean, that affected the Odd Fellows and all kinds of other similar sorts of organizations. But it's very much seen, leadership is very much seen as a kind of apprenticeship. And May was telling me about one particular provincial leader who, in fact, skipped a couple of levels and for one reason or another, as she landed in the president's chair, and she was resented for the entire period she was there. Respected but not loved.
Nancy Langford again. I just want to concur with you about the sources issue so that Alvin knows that I worked with very few sources to do my history as well. And I had the same experiences of women really, really reluctantly handing over anything. And it was really difficult. It's not an easy process during women's history, because even though they may have kept some things, it's so scattered, it's so private. You have to really dig sometimes, as you say, in private collections to get them. So it's not a, in fact, I'm a little jealous because I think you had more to work with than I did with your organization. I think they did a better job of maintaining the records from the sounds of it. Also, as we know, the UFA government is notorious for having destroyed the records. So the same thing happened in the organizations that supported that government. The UFA and the UFWA records are very spotty in the early years because most of them were destroyed. So that's one thing. But I have a question for you, too, about Roberta McAdams. Because did you run across a significant amount of information about her and about the government program that she was part of and the education train? The original institute was really a train that went around to provide educational programs. That was sort of the beginning point for most of its original, I think, thrust through the province. So I didn't hear much about that.
Yes, of course. We ran across material. I think someone's just written a book about her. In the histories of the organization, she's certainly there mentioned as the person who was hired by the government to conduct a survey to see whether or not the Women's Institute would be a viable thing. And there is a reasonable amount of material there about the demonstration trains. This is part of agricultural education, where trains would go out to rural areas, and cars would be devoted to adult education, and so they added on a women's car, you know, and so they would learn how to do various things that the home economists thought they should know. A certain amount as well, I think the WI, although Roberta McAdams was not part of WI, I think they're proud of the fact that she was the second woman elected to a legislature in the British Empire. And for those of you who are unaware of the history of Alberta in the firsts and women in government, is just extraordinary. So Louise McKinney, one of the famous five, in I think 1917, was the first woman elected to a legislature in the British Empire. And Roberta McAdams, who had been serving as a nurse overseas, was elected by the soldiers as the second. And Roberta was the first woman in the British Empire to bring a piece of legislation forth. And so those sorts of things are mentioned in the histories. but we don't have anything. We haven't collected any primary documents on her. I know that there's a lot of home economics related stuff at the Glenbow, and you've probably been down there, Nancy, but I haven't had a chance to go down and have a look and see what's there.
Just another question related to that. In terms of government records, has the government records kept track of that demonstration train program? I haven't looked into the government records on that one.
I haven't looked into it either.
Audrey O'Brien, just a quick question, Evelyn. This is so interesting. You talked about the decline of the WI and the map. Two little questions. Do you think it has any future at all? And might something like this, a digital collection that obviously raises the interest, might that even lead to some kind of resurrection of the movement?
Those are very good questions, and that was one of the first things we asked ourselves when we started looking at this. This is definitely a voluntary association that has outlived its time, and it's May and I figure no more than 5 years. They haven't attracted new members for decades. So part of it is their own fault. And this business of retaining things and being very, very... retaining things and not allowing people in. So in 100 years, this organization has only had 3 generations of leader. That's how long people hold on to those offices. So you've got the women coming at the turn of the century, their daughters born about the time of the First World War. That would be my mother's generation. So that's the second generation of WI. Then the third generation would be my generation, but most of us left the farm and went away. So that third generation, that's the age of person who's the leader now. The leaders are generally in their 60s now, and the members in the 70s, 80s, and 90s. So they've run out of steam, and they know it, but they keep meeting because they're friends, and they've always done it, and they still throw a few pennies towards their causes and so on, but... our project will be finished at the end of first part of 2010, and we've decided that we have ceased digitizing what we've got now, but when the organization folds, as it will do, and if we're both around to do something about it, we thought we might, we've been talking to the archives about tidying up some things, so getting the very last, so we've got a complete run of the Books of Remembrance, and the life membership and so on, but we're kind of stopping. The organization itself doesn't want to admit this, and so it's very, we don't say it out loud in their presence. I'm sorry, was there another question, Audrey? No.
Just to pick up on that last point, Archie here again, Evelyn, is it a trend or will you be looking at whether membership tends to flow from mother to daughter?
We're trying to determine that now. It actually doesn't seem to very well, even from first to second to third generations. There are not. I'm sorry, Patricia had to leave so early, but she had told me that she comes from a WI family, and her mother and grandmother were both in WI. I don't know whether Patricia has a membership or not, but that would be unusual. We found with so many people leaving the farm and moving to urban areas, that made a big difference. And I think the original reasons for having these institutes after that first generation in Alberta basically started to dissipate because the health department and the education department, all of these departments had started to function and the institutions were built and a lot of the reasons to have this kind of organization to make it habitable for their families and so on had been looked after. And as I said, then they started to look for good causes to support the Red Cross and so on. And that's a lot less tangible. And for many of them, it just became, if you happen to live in this small village or this small town, it was the big woman's club and you just joined it because you happened to be there. But fewer and fewer people were living in that area and the daughters actually were moving away. So, and I think that likely happened with UFWA, Nancy, would you not say?
To a certain extent, but because it was probably more farm family based and tied to the industry a little bit more, there tended to be more passing on to the next generation of that tradition, because it was, you know, had that sort of defending their occupation aspect to it, if they stayed in farming, if the children, you know, picked up and continued to farm, which didn't always happen either, of course.
Go ahead, Joe, if you want to press the...
Were there any questions from any of our off-site participants?
Have your question.
There we go. Microphone on now. Yeah, Joe Rosich here. I'm the Administration Production Coordinator for the Heritage Resources Management Program. And just sort of following up with a comment that was made a little earlier and in the conversation about the potential for this to perhaps tie into the program here, the Heritage Resources Program, seems to me that there would be a very good fit, particularly with our practicum components. So it's something that we can definitely look at, and it's a nice illustration of a very practical application in the actual program that we run here of the sort of work you're doing here. So thanks to some of the technical issues with Illuminate, I think quite a few of us joined a bit late. That was one of them. So I didn't catch the earlier part of the presentation, but I've looked around on the site and it looks fantastic. So thanks very much for doing the work on this.
Thanks very much, Joe. We should talk. I have to figure out how to use all this silly equipment. Thanks. Oh, and I'm to remind you and everyone else that the session has been recorded in case you've missed bits of it. I see a note here from Jay saying that he'd had some problems with Illuminate.
They,
so.
They send the wrong link out. Nobody was able to get in.
Oh,
I was trying to talk to Graham that it's fixed. So somebody we finally found a new one. Everybody a little
okay. All right. Apparently the wrong link had gone out.
Nancy here. I just have one piece of information that I want to pass on after that last person's comment. We have would be working on. Okay, Nancy Langford here. Just to put a piece of information to follow up on that last person's comment. We have asked for a Heritage Resource intern position at the AU Archives to work on sites like this one and the site that Women's Studies has that I am currently coordinating, that Evelyn referred to earlier, on women's history, as well as work in the archives and learn how to do archival work as well. So I'm hopeful that somehow we can get this position. So it, Dawn is aware of it and has been supporting it, and so has Women's Studies through Work and Community Studies, and we're just waiting to, you know, to see what happens with that. So just I want everybody to know about it, because I want you to know that we're trying hard to get, you know, some AU-based training in things like heritage websites and university archival type of work.
Oh, that's brilliant. We could think about all kinds of things for that person to do. Yeah.
Just Terry, one comment about is the next generation of the Women's Institute. I just punched in on Facebook, and there is no Women's Institute group, but there is one called the Women's Institute Scares the Crap Out of Me, and it looks like there's seven men who are in it.
I have one more question for you, Evelyn. Did you run across any documentation on the initiative they had on Farm Woman of the Year? Did they have anything?
I haven't noticed it.
When, okay.
Which year was it?
Because this was an initiative that I think they started in the late 70s or early 80s, and it was about a 20-year tradition, and I'm wondering if there was anything documented on that.
I haven't found anything, but I can look and ask around if you're interested in working on it.
Partly I'm wondering, because I think I have some documentation on that I should give you if you don't have any.
Yeah, definitely. Thank you.
Okay. Do we have any other comments from our off-site participants? I see that Jay enjoyed the talk and had trouble with the link. Okay, we'll go to on-site questions.
My name is Mike Rishka. I'm the husband of Evelyn. I know of your interest in book culture. I was wondering what contributions the Women's Institute have made to book culture in Alberta. Unless I missed it, I saw a lot of pamphlets being produced, but was there any other, like libraries and things like that? Thank you.
Well, I think probably the largest contribution you can say is that they were one of the strongest early promoters of libraries in the province. The IODE also was extremely active in probably even more than the WI in establishing libraries. But we've run across many, many places where the first libraries were, in fact, in the homes of WI members, and they gradually moved out from there. I think that would be the strongest connection to book culture, and that was essentially the reason that I gave myself permission to do this, was to look at that side of it. Within the organization, every year they have competitions for playwriting, which I think probably comes out of extension work in the 30s when that was a big focus for the Faculty of Extension at the University of Alberta. Playwriting, short story writing, and poems. Years ago, I actually was a judge for many of those things. May roped me in anonymously before I started working on the project, actually. And they have published collections of their own work. So I think library formation would probably be the answer there.
Well, it looks like everyone is sitting here in stunned silence, so perhaps we should thank you very much for a really interesting presentation and a lively discussion, and thanks again.